in Chicago FTD?
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Dan Geiser for Appellant Margaret Torres. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
Defendants are professional debt collectors. Their scheme involves intentionally flooding bankruptcy courts with time-barred claims.
Well, we understand what your argument is. Point us to the applicable statutory text and tell us why what they're doing, whatever scheme, however you characterize it, how it's inconsistent with the FDCA.
Well, with the
FDCPA.
It's inconsistent with the FDCPA in multiple respects. They're asserting a right to payment that doesn't exist. That's mischaracterizing the character and legal status of the debt.
But in fact,
a right to payment doesn't exist. The right to payment.
The right to payment doesn't exist.
It's the enforceability. It's the remedy.
Well, that is the right to payment, Your Honor. The Supreme Court has said on 4 separate occasions that the right to payment under the code, the definition of the code is section 101.5A, means a legally enforceable obligation. If you don't have a remedy, there's no way to enforce it. As this Court explained in Huertas, at that point it's a moral obligation, but there's no legal obligation.
But the key word there is obligation, not the adjective describing the kind of obligation it is. If the obligation still exists, why is it then inconsistent for them to file a claim based upon what you're conceding is an obligation which does exist?
Well, Your Honor, I actually think there's a different key word, according to the Supreme Court, which is enforceable. They didn't just say it had to be an obligation, it had to be an enforceable obligation. And the quintessential feature of a time-barred claim is it's no longer enforceable. At that point, it's a moral obligation, as 4 separate circuits have held.
But that could be decided in the bankruptcy code. That can be decided in the bankruptcy court. And you hear that it was disallowed. So why shouldn't that be decided in the bankruptcy court, where we encourage the filing of claims, unliquidated claims, contingent claims, something that's not readily enforceable? I mean, a contingent claim is not technically enforceable at this moment because something has not happened yet, but yet that's a claim and it should be filed so the bankruptcy court can decide it.
Well, Your Honor, I think there are 2 points here. The first is that we disagree that a contingent claim isn't an enforceable obligation. If I have a contingent contract, and let's say if something happens on a certain date, I have to pay money. If I declare today that I will breach that contract, even if that contingency occurs, I'm most certainly breaching that obligation. You could sue me for it and enforce it in court. That's very different than a time bar claim, which is not enforceable under any circumstances.
Well, that's not true. You could have a claim that's very stale, and if you get under Pennsylvania law, correct me if I'm wrong, if you get the debtor to acknowledge the debt owed, then that resurrects the claim, does it not?
It does, Your Honor, but it takes a separate independent legal act that doesn't exist under the current situation, which is
why... But in either way, you've got some conditions subsequent or some contingency that occurs, whether it's an unmatured claim, a contingent claim, an unliquidated claim. How are those qualitatively different from this time-barred claim, which also can be brought back to life?
Your Honor, I think that's what Congress had in mind when they said a contingent claim. I think that's clear from the text of the code. If you look to Section 502B1, it talks about you can't object on the grounds that the claim is contingent. But at the same time, Congress also said in Section 558 of the code that the statute of limitations is grounds for striking a proof of claim. So I don't think that's really what Congress had in mind. But even if you disagree with us on this, even if you think that a time-barred claim that's unequivocally time-barred on its face is still an enforceable obligation, even though the Supreme Court, I think, would disagree with that proposition, I think we still prevail because parties who file claims or any other document in the bankruptcy process have to have a good faith basis for the claim.
But why does the policy behind the FDCPA, how does that come into play at all in the context of the bankruptcy court system, where we encourage the filing of proofs of claim, we leave it to the bankruptcy court to police, there is an automatic stay provision so the debtor is not compelled the way the FDCPA wants to disincentivize. How does the policy of the FDCPA fit in the bankruptcy
code? There's a trustee in place also.
Well, to take them in turn, the policy of the FDCPA matches perfectly here. Congress contemplated bankruptcy directly in the FDCPA. They referred to bankruptcy in the purpose of the statute. It's an overlay to existing procedural protections. The protections under the code are calibrated.
How does a debtor in bankruptcy need protection?
Your Honor, they definitely need protection.
They're protected by the code.
They're protected by the code, but the code breaks down and fails. There is not a single instance where these claims are allowed unless the bankruptcy process breaks down and fails.
Even if the claim is allowed, the debtor must not write a check. It just dissipates the percentage that other creditors will get. So there's not the same situation as you have outside of bankruptcy, is it?
Your Honor, that's not true for 100% plans. For 100% plan, every single penny that the debtor is paying is going to the creditor. So if a time-barred claim is approved, it actually hurts the debtor directly, even without a 100% plan. Unfortunately, most Chapter 13 cases, they fail. They're converted to Chapter 7 or they're dismissed. Statistics suggest about two-thirds, actually, are dismissed, converted.
And I assume, is this in the record, or is this Geyser in bankruptcy?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Is this in the record, or is this Geyser in bankruptcy?
There are statistics that suggest this, but even without that,
Where are statistics? It's like listening to the news and the presidential campaigns. I need something to hang on to with a clear statement.
I apologize, Your Honor. There have been studies. I do not recall if we recited them in our reply brief or not, but I think we can all agree that not every Chapter 13 plan succeeds. And we did cite
So then there's no discharge? Is that what you're saying?
There's no discharge, and so that every legitimate creditor, their claim has been paid down less. So the debtor is left with a higher balance on the legitimate claims.
But a lot of cases do involve a discharge, right?
Yes, they do.
And in a strange way, what I find sort of ironic is, you know, the FDCPA, as I understand it, is all about protecting the citizenry from getting badgered by debt collectors and overbearing efforts to pursue people, right? You agree on that, right?
Well, I agree that that's one purpose, the only one.
Right, but one of the ironies of your argument, as I understand it, is, correct me if I'm wrong, is that for those that get a discharge, if you lose the case and people get a discharge, then those bothersome debt collectors won't keep coming after people. If you win the case, there's nothing to prevent them from calling somebody every month saying, hey, you know, you owe me $1,000, even if that debt statute of limitations ran 5 years ago. Isn't that right?
There actually is something that prevents it. It's in the FDCPA itself, under Section 1692C, subsection C. A debtor simply has to inform the debt collector in writing, I won't pay this debt, I have these communications going forward.
Well, but only a tiny percentage of people invoke that.
Well, you know, I think as Chief Judge Wood pointed out in the Seventh Circuit and as Judge Diaz pointed out in the Fourth Circuit, debtors are far more concerned about paying time-barred debts that they otherwise have no obligation to pay. And I think creditors are far more concerned about having their legitimate claims diluted because time-barred claims are submitted in the process.
Maybe the biggest hurdle in my own little feeble mind that gets in the way of your argument is 502B1 that states that the claim is using the bankruptcy code. The code provides for disallowance of claims that are, quote, unenforceable against the debtor or property of the debtor under applicable law. Now, doesn't that specifically allow for filings of claims where the obligation cannot be enforced because of statute of limitations? It does not mean that. What did Congress intend when they put 502B1 into the code?
Your Honor, I think there are multiple things Congress was thinking of. You need to have some provision to discard claims that are filed in good faith, but that may be untimely. And you do need some provision.
There's nothing here about good faith. Unenforceable against the debtor or property of the debtor under applicable law. It seems to me that the clearly saying a claim, the term claim is used in the code, does not exclude debts where the ability to collect on the debt is no longer legally enforceable.
Your Honor, again, we do think that the best reading of claim, because this is what the Supreme Court has told us it means, is that it has to be an enforceable obligation and a time our debt isn't. But even if you disagree on that.
The Supreme Court has told us. Is this the same book that has the statistics that you gave us, right?
No.
We've got Congress saying something different.
Your Honor, Congress said right to payment, and the Supreme Court said, considering what they described as the plain language of right to payment, it has to be an enforceable obligation. This isn't Geiser on bankruptcy. This is Davenport, Johnson, Next Wave.
Okay, what about Congress on bankruptcy as pronounced in 502B1?
502B1 said Congress needed to have some mechanism so that when a creditor files a claim that, in fact, is not enforceable or files something that's frivolous or fraudulent, they need to have some way to discard it from the procedure.
But it anticipates that they will be filed and that's fine. There's sanctions
here. Your Honor, that same argument would suggest that under Rule 11, the Rules Committee assumes the parties will file frivolous litigation and they quit, or that under Title 18, Congress assumes people are permitted to commit felonies.
Rule 11 provides sanctions. This doesn't have a sanction.
Yes, it does, Your Honor. Under Rule 9011, which is the counterpart to Rule 11, they're cut from the same cloth. Courts have said that they're construed exactly the same way, that every claim filed in the bankruptcy process has to have a good faith basis in its enforceability. So here, debt collectors are filing claims that they know should lose. If anyone objects, they walk away or they agree that they're wrong.
So there's sanctions under the Bankruptcy Code. Why would we then not be content to have sanctions under the Bankruptcy Code and not incorporate something that's not intended to be the bankruptcy sanction?
Well, Your Honor, the FTCPA is an overlay to the Bankruptcy Code. That might be a good argument in a preemption.
Well, that's your argument. Who says that?
In a preemption context, it might matter that there's the remedies that exist. In a preclusion context, as this Court recognized in Simon, unless a positive repugnancy between the two laws, this is what Johnson explained in the 11th Circuit, it has to be incompatible to enforce both at the same time. In this case, it's very easy to enforce both. The claims process is wholly permissive. No one is required to file a claim that they know is frivolous, that they will concede, and I'll be surprised.
Frivolous. You're equating frivolous with legally unenforceable. I'm not sure that's an appropriate context to draw, given what I just told you what 502B1 says. If frivolous means unenforceable, then 502B1 makes absolutely no sense, because it allows for the filing of frivolous claims.
Your Honor, I think 502B1, again, is a procedure that exists that you can dispatch claims that don't belong in the process.
You're substituting your language for what Congress said. What you can do is dismiss claims that are not enforceable under applicable law.
Exactly.
But it's a claim.
Well, no, because a claim is not defined under 502B1. It's defined under Section 101.5A. But again,
why is 502B1 in there? What does it mean?
And the claim under 101 does not say legally enforceable.
It's his right to payment, but again, Your Honor, I think with all respect, the Supreme Court and four separate agents has said that the plain language of that statutory meaning is an enforceable obligation. And they said not just an enforceable obligation, it's nothing more nor less than an enforceable obligation.
Were those all in the statute of limitations context?
This is not in the statute of limitations context, but it's in four separate factual backdrops.
Because to my mind, statute of limitations is an affirmative defense.
Right.
I have a difficult time saying that it really, that you can't come into court and ask.
Isn't that the nub of this case? It's not self-executing. You know, there may be some other claims, none come to mind immediately, that just are dead on arrival in a self-executing way, but isn't Judge Rendell right because this is an affirmative defense that makes it different?
Judge Rendell is right that this is an affirmative defense, but I don't think it makes a difference. And we cited cases from four different circuits.
Why not? If it's an affirmative defense and it's not self-executing, don't we all as lawyers, when we're representing clients, and a client walks into your office and they've got a good cause of action, and someone owes them damages because of a tort or a contract or anything else, don't we as lawyers have an obligation, even after we say, oh my goodness, they came to me 6 months too late, don't you have an obligation to plead that?
You
hope the other side makes the same mistake the first lawyer that they went to made.
Your Honor, absolutely not. And we cite cases from the Fifth Circuit, the Seventh Circuit, the Tenth Circuit, and I believe I'm missing one. There's one more that we actually do cite in our briefs.
So you tell that client, you have a great cause of action, I'd love to get you $10 million for the fact that you're now a quadriplegic, but I'm not going to put that cause of action in because it's time barred.
If it's a time barred claim, the law under Rule 11, which I think is settled, and I haven't seen anything to suggest that there's a different rule somewhere else. If you are aware of an ironclad affirmative defense, you cannot submit that claim.
But there's never anything ironclad because you're always going to try to concoct an equitable tolling argument. You know, for every rule, there's an exception, right?
And if you have a good faith basis for filing it, that's not what we're talking about today. We're not talking about claims that are debatable. We're talking about claims that are knowingly time-barred. In fact, one of the arguments that the
defendants... But we're using language that is not in what seems to be pretty clear language of 502B1. Your arguments are very good arguments, but they're not based upon the text that I just gave you of 502B1.
Your Honor, I think it is based on a fair reading, both of what the Supreme Court said the definition of claim is, based on the structure of the code, looking at 502B1, 558, the duty imposed on the trustee to object to baseless claims. I think it's consistent with Rule 9011, which says you need a good faith basis for every filing. I don't think Congress had to expressly say that baseless, frivolous claims are forbidden in order to forbid baseless and frivolous claims.
When they define claims, they don't talk about good faith or the mindset of the creditor. They simply talk about a right to payment. And then getting back to Judge Rendell's point, even if it's a contingent claim, and the point for contingency has not yet occurred, that nevertheless is under the code, it is a claim. Reading that together with 502B1, it seems to be pretty clear that even though a claim may not be enforceable, and that's under applicable law, and that is the statutory text, it is still, nevertheless, a claim under the bankruptcy code.
Your Honor, but again, you still need to get...
Right? That's so simple. Why are you trying to make something
simple? Well, because I actually think it's very simple.
More complicated, I guess, the better your chances of winning it.
I fully agree, but I actually think the simplest way to do this is to take the Supreme Court to mean what it's plainly said on separate occasions.
But it was not statute of limitation cases.
They weren't.
But they did. It was essential components that was tied up to the reasoning that the court had in their actual holdings.
Right, but they haven't had this case before them.
No, and that's certainly true.
Maybe a contender.
We actually have two separate cert petitions that are pending right now.
Should we stay this case? What are those going to be ruled on? How close are those?
They should be distributed today for the October 7th conference, so that they are coming up fairly soon. Now, it is also an eight-member court at the moment, so we don't know if they're going to review or not. I'm sure they'd appreciate this court's input. Let me try this from a different perspective because I think it may help. The entire purpose of the code, the reason that we want claims included in the process, it's twofold. It's one, to give the debtors a fresh start. They need the broadest relief possible so that they're not crushed down by these financial obligations. That point doesn't help the debtors here because these claims are already time-barred. Chief Judge Wood explained this in her dissent. They don't need the protection of the discharge.
The operative language there in that sentence you just used is not Chief, not Judge, not Wood, it's dissent.
That's fair, but it's also the Seventh Circuit, which doesn't bind this court in its independent review of the law. But I think that the debtors aren't benefited by including frivolous time-barred claims. It actually burdens the process where everyone has to object to these claims that should be rejected and will be rejected every single time unless there's a malfunction.
But that's an argument you make to Congress, not to this court, which has to look at 502B1, and my little feeble mind is reading 502B1 in a way that's very simple, and you're trying to make it very complicated for me.
I think the simplest way to approach this is putting aside the bankruptcy code for a moment. Is that
I know that would be a very simple way. Let's put the statutes aside. Let's put the precedents aside.
The question right now is whether these are unfair or unconscionable claims or whether they're deceptive or misleading. And so even saying, let's pretend that it's not actually a deceptive and misleading characterization of the status or character of the debt to say I have an enforceable obligation when they don't. Let's put that aside. It's certainly unfair and unconscionable to submit a claim in a process that should lose every single time as Congress intended. And we know this because, as you pointed out, Your Honor, under 502B1, you can object to claims that are unenforceable under applicable law. We know from 558 that debtor can't.
The sentence you just said, you used unenforceable law, unenforceable, but you still recognize that those are, quote, claims, just close quote. And claims, that's the term that we're hung up on here.
Your Honor, I don't think Congress had to say a purported claim to convey its base intent, but putting that aside, it's very clear that these claims are supposed to lose. There is no scenario, 100% of the time.
Lost.
But
they're allowed to be filed. And if a creditor can't participate in the bankruptcy process without violating the Fair Debt Collection Act, isn't there a direct conflict here?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. The question is, why aren't they, what are they losing by not filing a claim?
That's not the point.
What's the claim?
It's when they file a claim and say, please, include me in this process, and then they get slapped with a fair debt collection practice.
They have no basis for being included in the process, and they're violating Rule 911 by submitting your claim.
Why don't we hear from Mr. Maurice, and we'll get you back on.
All right. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Donald Maurice. I represent Calvary SPV1. I think that we talked about the Seventh Circuit a moment ago when we were talking about a claim. This Court has spent decades describing what a claim is. And the Third Circuit has treated it in the broadest possible sense. And in fact, in In re Grossman's, the Third Circuit said, it's more extensive than a state cause of action. Meaning, you don't have to be able to sue in a state court to have a claim. When debtors file bankruptcy, especially Chapter 13 wage earner plans, it's a very important decision they have to make. Why are they doing it? Is it because of lawsuits? Maybe. But I bet you more times than not, it's due to phone calls, it's due to letters. And so when we look at a claim, do we have to say that it's simply something to sue on in state court, or as the Third Circuit has said in In re Rodriguez? It's just enough to be able to ask for a payment. That's what the 13 stops. And how does it stop it? 362A, the automatic stay. And it's interesting what the language of 362A says, that it will stay any act to collect, assess, or recover a claim. Not a debt, a claim. Why? Because the moment Ms. Torres filed her Chapter 13 petition, all creditors with claims, whether they had notice or not, were stayed, including Calvary. Calvary has a right under state law to make phone calls and letters to Ms. Torres.
And that basically, accomplishes the purpose of the FDCPA, does it not?
Exactly. Exactly. What are we here for? We're here because creditors are participating in a process that, what is the end result? To stay their collection actions and to discharge their debts? And that's abusive and harmful to consumers? No, quite the opposite. That's what the code's intended to do, and it works. And it worked here with Calvary. Calvary put its claim in. As the record shows, it purchased the debt 7 years before the bankruptcy. Obviously, its efforts failed. Debtor files bankruptcy. Calvary files the claim, acknowledging we're part of the process. There's no due process concerns now because Calvary clearly has notice, right, actual notice, and they participated. The claim's disallowed, and we're done.
Why isn't it unfair and unconscionable? I mean, it's hard not to say that this whole scheme is really tawdry.
Well, no, I don't think so, Judge. The creditors have something. They don't have the right to sue. Many of our FDCPA cases are not about suing. Lawsuits for $300 debts are not the usual means that people take to collect debts. It's phone calls and letters. There's still a right under state law. It's a property right. That's what Judge Barnes says that in Glenn. I agree. And that's what's so troubling to Judge Rubino below, the tension. We have the bankruptcy court taking away something from a creditor. And we're about to tell that creditor, you can't participate. Even though you're stayed, even though you're likely going to be permanently enjoined forever doing something that is entirely permissible under state law to do, we're going to permanently enjoin you and you have no right to be heard. That's wrong.
But how analytically do we say that this can't be? Is this, would you adhere to Chief Judge Jacob's opinion in Simmons' case in the Second Circuit or the Fourth Circuit case? And how analytically? Are we talking here about preemption? Are we talking about legislative history because there's an ambiguity? Are we talking about total conflict of these laws?
I think every court that's looked at this since Crawford has come to at least one conclusion. We have a claim. Even the 11th Circuit had to concede that in Johnson versus Midland. Every other circuit, the 4th and the 7th and the 8th, have said it's simply not a violation because it is permitted.
So you don't get into the conflict.
You never get into it. Everyone says, all we're saying is,
It's not a violation because your argument is that the bankruptcy code says this is the way it works.
And
the way it works is, and anyone who's ever done any bankruptcy cases know, people are lobbing in claims left and right, and there's they take a lot of liberties about valuing those claims, et cetera, and you're just saying this is the way the process works.
It's the way the process works that way to encourage creditor participation because we want to bring all these claims in so the debtor gets the ultimate relief. If we have to sit there, we're going to say now there's a risk for a creditor, the FDCPA, to file a proof of claim. Creditors are going to say, I don't want to file a proof of claims anymore. Even if there's the slightest risk, we're discouraging their participation by doing this.
That would help the debtor.
Oh, no, I don't think it helps. I think it helps the creditor, actually, in the end result.
Well, if creditors are afraid to file claims, then the debtor is
going to get discharged. Yeah. And if we say it's not a claim, under 362A6, it doesn't get stayed.
I see. So there's no, the process doesn't reach its logical conclusion. There's no fresh start, and you're right back to square one.
You're right back to square one, because okay. Once you get into the denial of due process, once you say a creditor can't participate, well, we're going to try to discharge its claim, that's where you run into that problem. That's the tension Judge Rubino saw and Judge Barnes saw in Ray Glenn that we cited in our papers.
Thank you. By the pause, I assume you were concluding even though you have more time left.
I think we answered all the questions. Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Geiser? See how he thought when his green light was still on? Do you see that?
I did. I was.
That was exemplary, wasn't that?
It's excellent advocacy, but I'm going to try one more time because I'm convinced that we actually have some good points here, and I hope that I can convince you too.
Let's get your green light going because I get offensive. We have enough time to get you to stop when the red light comes on. Okay, go ahead.
I think the first point I'd like to make is that. My friend suggests that we're taking away a right from creditors, but the right we're taking away is to file an absolutely frivolous claim that we'll lose every single time unless the system malfunctions. This is not going to deter any legitimate creditor from participating in the process. Under the FDCPA...
But why is it you're equating frivolous with time-barred? And I think we've talked about this before. Under the lottery, a time-barred claim may well not be frivolous. There may be an intervening... offer to pay, there may be some kind of tolling there. The fact that the time is run under the statute does not mean at all that as a matter of law the statutory bar is going to be operative against the creditor. It may be, it usually is, but it may not be.
Your Honor, we're not talking about claims that have a good faith basis for believing they can have relief from the time bar. We're talking about claims that everyone agrees are absolutely time barred. Claims that when the debt collector submits them, they know to a certainty.
Well, but how do you know that if you're a creditor that I'm absolutely time-barred, or there's a question about whether I'm time-barred, or, I mean, if you're going to draw those lines, it's just
from the defendants in this case have suggested that the reason these claims aren't misleading is because they're so clearly baseless on their face that no one, including unrepresented debtors, could possibly be deceived. So I think this is a situation where professional debt collectors are certainly aware of what they're doing. And what they're doing
they
is...
They purchased the debt before it was time-barred.
Exactly, and they purchased it they purchased everything after it was time-barred, and they purchased debts at a reduced price because they're time-barred.
So why wouldn't any trustee worth her salt simply do an omnibus objection to every claim filed by professional companies like this? Isn't that automatic?
It isn't, Your Honor, because the trustee needs a good faith basis for their objection.
Yeah, the good faith basis is, Judge, these sharks are in the business of trying to collect legally time-barred claims, and that's why I did an omnibus objection objecting to every claim that company put forward.
Your Honor, if trustees did that, this scheme wouldn't exist because they lose every single time.
Maybe it shouldn't exist. Wouldn't that be a nice thing, right?
It would be fantastic, but the FDCPA is designed to deter professional debt collectors. These are different than ordinary creditors.
This is one heck of a deterrence. He just positive to you. That's big-time deterrence.
Well, for claims, again, well, let's be very clear what we're talking about. Claims that the debt collectors are submitting without any good faith basis for believing they're enforceable. So if anyone objects, they immediately throw in the towel and walk away. We're not talking about claims that are debatable. That's different, and they have a defense built into the FCPA that protects them as long as they have procedures that are reasonably adapted to avoid violations. So this will not deter legitimate conduct. The only thing this deters is the filing of claims that they know are illegitimate, that they know will lose every single time, 100% of the time, if the system functions as Congress wanted it to. They only collect when the system malfunctions. I think that's a definition of an unfair and unconscionable practice.
So what about 362? Mr. Maurice's point is if you don't include these claims because they're time-barred, the debt collector can still, not in an abusive way that violates the FDCPA, but can still send letters, can still make phone calls because it's not, the automatic stay is not operating. And after the bankruptcy, the debt is still going to be there. It's no less enforceable now than it was before the bankruptcy proceeding. How does that help the debtor?
No, they aren't concerned about time-barred debts when they declare bankruptcy.
Maybe they should be, though.
They're concerned about the persistent phone calls, aren't they?
They are, but they
can't. Again, we get back to the point, one of the central points of the FDCPA being passed.
Your Honor, and the FDCPA has a built-in provision that compensates for that. Again, 1692C, subsection C. They can cut it off with a simple letter.
Write the letter, yeah, because everyone is so knowledgeable about that. Subsection C, and they all have time to do it. They know where to start.
The Apple user agreement. It's not going to happen.
But again, but Congress is far more concerned about providing a heightened scheme of punishment and remedies for professional debt collectors who are not ordinary creditors, who aren't subject, they don't respond in the same way to the general scheme in the code that deals with ordinary general creditors. These are professionals, and Congress has these two schemes that work together. They overlay each other. There's no positive repugnancy. And the question is, if it applies on its face, then the court has to enforce both laws unless it is, in fact, an irreconcilable conflict.
Okay.
And here it is.
I'm tempted to say that brings us back to 502B1. I'm not going to go back into that water. But we do understand your argument.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Take the matter in advisement.